Hello and welcome to Asia in Depth. I'm Michelle Flor-Cruz. On August 31st, the U.S. military completed its withdrawal from Afghanistan, officially marking the end of America's 20-year war in the country. But the end of the war has raised a number of critical questions about the humanitarian consequences, the stability of the region, and what life under Taliban rule might look like. In a special conversation hosted by Asia Society Northern California, Tamim Asai, founder and executive chairman of the Institute of War and Peace Studies and an Asia Society Asia 21 fellow, and Barnett Rubin, senior fellow at NYU's Center on International Cooperation, discuss the circumstances of the U.S. withdrawal as well as what's next for Afghanistan. The conversation was moderated by Rina Amiri, who is a senior fellow at both the Center of International Cooperation and the Center for Global Affairs at NYU. Tamim Asai begins the conversation.
The perspectives I give is, of course, the perspective that I think is not heard much in the media, given my discussions with the leadership, former leadership of the Afghan National Defense and Security Forces. The first one, why the rapid collapse of the Afghan National Defense and Security Forces that came was essentially the design of that force. It was designed as a very dependent force where the critical enablers, specifically the back-end and logistical and intelligence support, came from the international forces, former ISAF and recently Resolute Support Mission. That is one of the reasons. The second one was the flawed peace process, which started under President Trump, and then it was owned by President Biden, of course. That demoralized the Afghan forces, what I often refer to as the 3D effect, which is the demoralization, defections, and then dwindling resources. Essentially, the Afghan forces, when the Qatar and the Doha process started, started asking themselves this question: why should we fight an enemy when our international partners, whose motto was that we are with you, Shana Bashana, which is shoulder to shoulder, why should we fight when they have stopped fighting? And not only that they have stopped fighting the Taliban, they are having dinners and breakfasts and nice time with them. And also the international security forces, specifically NATO forces and the American forces, put lots of restrictions on the three critical enablers for ANDSF as they were negotiating the peace process. First was the critical air support. They were only supporting in a limited manner the Afghan forces in very specific cases. Secondly, on intelligence and reconnaissance, they were also limiting themselves to certain functions, and finally on the medical evacuation and also logistical support. The laser, I'm just going to give you an example. For example, the laser-guided bombs, which was so critical for the Afghan Air Force, that was a cap was put onto it. And during the last days of the last months of the Afghan, of the former Afghan government, they essentially stopped supplying those bombs to the Afghan forces. And I could go on and give other examples where the American forces stopped delivering some of the critical enablers. The final thing, which really not many people talk about, is essentially the Afghan army was not an army. I mean, it was an auxiliary force. Every army has 8 classes. It's infantry, you know, the intelligence class, the logistic class, the telecom and technician class. The Afghan army and the Air Force, you know, other classes, which every army requires. The Afghan forces were essentially an infantry with some, was augmented with a halfway, you know, Air Force and some intelligence classes. The 5-6 other classes, which was so critical, including the logistical class, was not there because the Afghan forces were depending on the Combined Security Assistance Command for Afghanistan, SISTICA. So SISTICA was providing all the critical backend support. Now, I feel very disappointed when I hear in the international media, as well as when I heard the recent hearings at the Senate and the Congress, where they blame that the Afghan forces have actually stopped fighting and we were giving them all they needed. That's not true. In fact, they stopped and limited support to the Afghan forces. And if the Afghan forces were not fighting, why did they lose 65,000 men and women? 65,000 men and women, Afghan National Defense and Security Forces, laid their lives and gave the ultimate sacrifice to defend the Republic. So therefore, I think those were the critical causes for the collapse of those forces. And that's why they just stopped fighting.
Thank you. Thank you for a really comprehensive answer that captures the complexity behind a situation that, was so unexpected. Barney, my question to you is about the Taliban. You are seen as one of the pioneering voices that that pushed for an engagement with the Taliban, talks with the Taliban, and a political settlement. In fact, you were seen as really the most instrumental actor in the Obama administration in making the case. Given the recent developments with the Taliban in terms of the course of action that they've taken with the military takeover, the composition of the caretaker government with over 20 sanctioned individuals, including two that are designated by the FBI, and the policies that they have enacted in the last 2 months. What surprises you? What were your expectations? And maybe it's a two-part question. And what do you see ahead in terms of their own possibilities for greater inclusivity and stability?
Well, thank you, Rina. It's a pleasure and honor for me to be here with a panel chaired by you and with Tamim as well. The idea of a political settlement with the Taliban was not predicated on any hypothesis about the nature of the Taliban. It was predicated on the fact that we were losing the war and that we did not have any way of winning the war, and that it was also inevitable that the United States would leave Afghanistan. So the question is, if it were to leave in a responsible way, there should be a political transition to something that is sustainable after the U.S. troops leave. The U.S. tried to act as, at first as if the Taliban would disappear, but they didn't disappear. They became stronger and stronger. And therefore, the question was how to bring them into the system. Now, a negotiated settlement is not the same as the collapse of the government and the takeover by the Taliban. The military takeover by the Taliban was, in fact, I always thought that negotiations on a political settlement was a way to prevent the military takeover of by the Taliban. And of course, the type of government that an armed opposition or insurgent group establishes very much reflects the way that they came to power. If the Taliban had joined a government through negotiations and a power-sharing agreement, which is what the whole process was aimed at, then it would have empowered those in the Taliban who were engaged in the negotiation, who supported the negotiations. As it happened, since those negotiations failed at the last minute for reasons we could discuss if we wanted to later, the military forces took over of the Taliban and were able to claim, as apparently they did, that their victory was due to their fighters and not due to the diplomats. And therefore they, with apparently some support from Pakistan as well, they managed, they monopolized the positions in the government. Now, what's, of course, what's difficult now is that the Afghanistan remains one of the absolutely most externally dependent countries in the world. It's not only the military that is externally dependent. The food supply, the money, the healthcare system, the education, all of those things are now grinding to a halt and may collapse because of a lack of aid, because, of course, no one is giving aid to the Taliban. And the Taliban also do not seem to have not made any gesture or any even the slightest movement toward the international community in a way that would enable the international community to provide the assistance that Afghanistan really needs. They haven't there are members of the Taliban leadership who clearly do understand that, and they've articulated it, but those who are in charge now do not seem to understand that. I could go on with the various things that they've done. So we're now in a kind of standoff, and I'm afraid that there's been this standoff between the international community and the Taliban. The big losers are the Afghan people who are being held hostage.
Thank you, Barney. I'll pick up where you left off in terms of the situation of, inside Afghanistan, in particular, the situation of the population inside the country. A lot of the focus in the last 2 months have been on those Afghans who've been fleeing Afghanistan, the evacuations, and there has been less attention to the 38 million people who are still inside the country and where they're facing an economic collapse. The international community, because of the sanctions regime and the nature of the caretaker government, this lack of representation and inclusion, has halted aid, frozen assets, and what's left, halted development aid. And where what has been left in place is the possibility of providing aid to the population through humanitarian assistance. And already we see that the situation is quite dire. The prices have skyrocketed. People are selling the household items for food. And we face a situation where over 18 million people face food insecurity. And by next year, the UN assessment is that over 97% of the population will be at the poverty line. So Tim John, I turn to you. A key question is where the international community sees, by international people, let's be frank, we're talking about the West, where much of the money is, that they see the aid as being a main source of leverage, and do not believe that they should move on this issue until there is, that the Taliban needs some level of conditionality in terms of inclusion, in terms of adjusting some of the other conditions in regard to breaking ties with Al-Qaeda among others. But there is a very dire situation, as I've noted, in terms of where the meeting the needs of the population. What would be your position in terms of how the international community should be approaching this issue and balancing this, you know, very very challenging predicament?
So first, I lived during the Taliban time in 1990s. I think our Western friends, and including some of the regional ones, really don't understand how the Taliban think and govern. They barely care about their leverages. They are a fundamentalist ideological movement. And even their transformation from an insurgency and a military force to a government, they barely pay attention to that. Yes, there are some within their leadership who are well-versed, well-traveled, and also what experience from the last emirate, the experience that they have, that they understand these things. But essentially, if you could not leverage 150 or 200,000 military force on them, forget about leveraging aid or humanitarian assistance for them. I think that is one. So we really need to first understand the Taliban, what their worldview. And when we say the Taliban, of course, there are different branches within the Taliban. They're not monolithic, and they are also not homogeneous. I mean, there are different groups, the Haqqani faction, the Bradar faction, and the other factions, that when it comes to politics, they look very monolithic and homogeneous, but inside they have their fractures, of course, and how they want to approach things. Secondly, the priority of the international community with 100,000 or whatever number of the high-risk people that they evacuated, and Afghans who have been evacuated are grateful for that. But there is that 38 million and 95% of them living in poverty. And the majority of them in the provinces. I mean, the focus of the international community has been on the airport and evacuations, not even Kabul. And then now a little Kabul-centric, but there are 34 other provinces where there are a lot of people living, and there's not much talked about, and they are living at the edge of poverty. In terms of priorities of the West when it comes to Afghanistan and even the region, it is security, which is effectively counterterrorism, and then politics, the questions of inclusivity, broad-based governance, and then it's humanitarian development aid. I think we have got that wrong. The priority should be upside down, that you need to first focus on development and humanitarian aid and find ways that you could deliver that through UN agencies and others, respecting all those sanctions and freezing of assets. Because if you expect to use them as a leverage, I think you're banging your head against the wall. Barely the Taliban care, and then focus on the politics and the security aspects of it. But it seems like the international community, specifically the Western part, but also some of the regional actors, such as China and Russia, specifically, and some of the Central Asian players, they're so focused on Al-Qaeda and on some of the regional terrorist outfits that CT is the top priority for them. Not realizing that actually a social implosion and an economic collapse and financial collapse will provide the breeding ground for the Al-Qaeda's and for the regional terror outfits to start developing a sympathetic population and recruiting people and reestablishing their safe havens and training camps. This is exactly what happened when I lived in Herat, because the poverty was so bad in the 1990s that besides the Herat airport, there was a big camp, a terror camp, which we understood later on, Taliban referred to it as a, madrasa. But years later, we came to know that it was actually a terrorist training camp. And they took people, young people, recruit them and get them there. So this economic humanitarian situation is dire, but that economic humanitarian situation, if it's not addressed, will turn into a security, military, terrorism even problem, which would amplify the security challenges for the West and for the region.
Thank you very much, Temujin. I'm going to turn to the regional aspect, which Temujin, you've already started talking about. Now, the equation has changed significantly, whereas in the last 20 years, the West was in the most influential position. Now, there has been an exodus of Western embassies, and the region is playing a much more prominent role and is in a more decisive position. And the region has a different stance vis-a-vis the Taliban, by and large. There is their position is one in which there should be a restraint in terms of rushing to judgment on the Taliban, and that there should be more engagement and a critical lens vis-a-vis the international community for cutting off development aid. At the same time, there hasn't been very much that's been coming forth in terms of their own preparedness to provide additional aid. They've also made certain statements in terms of what it would take for them to recognize the Taliban, and Imran Khan, as well as and Putin, have both noted that there would be a unity in terms of a decision vis-a-vis recognizing the Taliban. So Barney, I would like you to build on that and just note in terms of what are some of the more critical issues. Temujin noted that it's CT, but what are some of the critical issues? How can the region be brought in a more constructive way by the international community to engage the Taliban in a way that would address some of the big challenges that we face in Afghanistan?
Okay, well, thank you. I just want to make one other comment, which is just to make it clear, there is no political conditionality on humanitarian assistance. And we hope that the UN and its associated organizations will ramp up and provide that humanitarian assistance, and that they will find a way to include some things that perhaps are beyond the realm of humanitarian assistance normally, such as paying the salaries of the healthcare workers and the teachers in the health and educational system so that those national systems can operate to a certain extent. I believe they are now looking for ways to do that without putting the money through the Taliban. Now, in terms of the region, since about 2016, Russia in particular has been leading an effort to create a consensus among Pakistan, China, Russia, and Iran. And if you look at a map, you will see that's a very important group of countries because Afghanistan is landlocked and no other countries can get to Afghanistan without the cooperation of one of those four countries, except for Central Asia, of course. But for someone outside of Asia, they can't get there without the cooperation of Russia and China, plus some Central Asian countries. So now with the withdrawal of the United States, the end of the supplies coming through Pakistan for American troops, the region is in a position to have much more influence in Afghanistan. But on the other hand, they don't necessarily have the resources or the means to exercise it. Initially, all of those countries had developed political relations with the Taliban because while they, none of them actually, except for Pakistan, none of them actually supported the Taliban or wanted to tell them to take power, they also felt equally, if not more, threatened by the presence of the U.S. military there. So they had to balance those two threat perceptions that they had. And they partly to put more pressure on the U.S. to leave and partly to try to assure a smooth transition when inevitably the U.S. military did leave, they developed political relations with the Taliban. Now, since the time since the Taliban took power and formed their government, you have begun to see, I believe, some divisions within that group and a breaking of the consensus. In particular, when Putin says there should be a consensus about recognizing the Afghan government, the Taliban government, and when Imran Khan says there should be a consensus, they actually have completely opposite things in mind. Because Imran Khan means there should be a consensus, and he very much wants everyone to, at least in the region, to recognize the Taliban government and engage with them more or less unconditionally. And China, in a more modest way, has been taking that position. But of course, China is very, very cautious about what they will do. Russia and Iran, however, are very concerned by the nature of the interim government, the so-called interim government that the Taliban have named, in particular, its lack of ethnic inclusivity. I wish I could say they were concerned about the fact that it doesn't include women, but I don't think that they actually are. But Afghans are concerned about that and some other foreigners. But Russia and Iran both believe that the lack of ethnic and social inclusivity in the Taliban government will be a certain cause of future instability. And I might note just there's a small trend that has started in just the past week or so. There has been a definite uptick in attacks that are attributed to or claimed by the Islamic State of Khorasan province, which is the branch of the Islamic State in Afghanistan. And a number of these have taken place in primarily Tajik areas. And there are reports coming now that ISKP is recruiting in northern Afghanistan from Tajik, so that it's possible, this is not certain yet, but that the ethnic resentments against the Taliban might not be translated into the into following leaders whom we're familiar with, like Ahmed Massoud or Amrullah Saleh, but might be translated into a more radicalized type of movement, which is a type of development that every country in the region has reason to fear.
Asia Society and the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts is excited to announce the East Coast premiere of Coal and Ice. The documentary photography exhibition brings together the work of over 40 photographers and video artists from around the world to visualize the climate crisis, its causes and consequences, as a large-scale immersive experience in Washington, D.C. Learn more about the free public exhibition and accompanying programmatic series, which will run from March 15th to April 22nd, 2022, by going to coalandice.org. That's coalandice.org. Now let's get back to the conversation.
What do you think some of the key misunderstanding between Afghanistan and the U.S.? How can people and organizations fight against potential stigmatization of Afghanistan and Afghan refugees? Tamjan, can I ask you to begin responding to that question?
So I believe there are two aspects of that question. First is the misunderstandings between the two governments that led to the collapse, and then the stigmatization of Afghan refugees who will be coming to the United States. First of all, I mean, the top three, four big misunderstandings that existed between the two governments, if I could put it that way, the former government and the United States. First, they had two different takes on peace process and the ultimate end state of any Afghan peace process. That is one, and they did not have one understanding of where ultimately the Doha peace talks would lead to. Secondly, the dependency factor led Afghans to believe that the United States would stay forever because of certain mythical understandings that they had about grand designs that the United States have for Afghanistan to counterbalance China, Russia. I remember I met former President Ghani once, even though I found him much more pragmatic than President Karzai when it came to some of these things, because Karzai has some really wild ideas. But even Ghani was under the impression that the United States, because of certain geopolitical interests, and he had calculations of if a U.S. jet, you know, is based in Afghanistan and tries to attack one of the neighboring countries, so much fuel is required, and I don't know so much distance, and how soon that particular aircraft would reach somewhere. So he believed that that the United States would not leave, and that underlying factor was because of the geopolitical calculations that he had. The third thing, I think, which really was the problem from the U.S. side, is that the U.S. really did not understand Afghan society and the Afghan culture, and even at the military side, the Afghan way of warfare. That is why they ill-designed, the army and the ANDSF and others. And finally, on the misunderstandings, the United States and Afghans were not on the same page when it came to the region. They had different takes of what, certain regional interests that they had would be, pursued. Now, in terms of stigmatization, I think the top three things I off the top of my head that comes first, not all Afghans, all of those folks who come are not terrorists and extremists. That's one. Secondly, there are many professionals there amongst them, doctors, engineers, lawyers. I mean, these are very educated people. Just because they don't know English, it doesn't mean that they haven't been educated or they don't know, their field. And finally, reach out to them, help them settle. But at the same time, some of these families require support, specifically mental health support. They might not show it, but later on, I think there would be a lot of need for that. So if you see anything irregular or abnormal about them, it's because of the trauma that they went through.
Could I add something to that, Rina?
Yes, please.
The need for that kind of mental health assistance is not limited to the few hundred thousand people who just escaped. They're not the only people in Afghanistan who have gone through trauma. All the 38 million or however many people there are in Afghanistan have gone through trauma. And there is a huge, along with all the other problems, there is a huge problem of undiagnosed mental and psychological problems in the Afghan population.
Thank you, Barney, and thank you, Tanisha. The next question is for both of you. What is the likelihood of the Taliban government collapsing or severely failing in terms of a delivery of basic services, providing security, and maintaining a minimum level of economic activity to finance a badly functioning state? And this is particularly, I think, an important question because of the level of aid dependency of the Afghan government.
No government in Afghanistan is capable of effectively governing the country unless it receives substantial amounts of foreign aid. And that as a result of the unsustainable institutions built by the United States for its short-term purposes, even though it did not have the intention of staying there forever, their Afghan state is now facing a bigger danger of collapse than it ever had faced before, because you've got a huge bubble economy that is collapsing. Now, whether that will lead to the breakdown of the Taliban government, I cannot say. As Tamim mentioned, they are not really very vulnerable to the type of normative pressure that we would like to put on them. However, there may come a point at which they could not pay or sustain their armed forces, in which case they would, you know, not be able to enforce security, and we'd see a rise in crime and so on, and, you know, and they might lose control of certain areas. It's possible. At the moment, the most active destabilizing force inside Afghanistan, as I said, appears to be the Islamic State. Although, I mean, the genuine destabilization is coming from the economic situation. So I think there's no way that the current situation in Afghanistan is completely unsustainable. The Taliban, by trying to rule by themselves, are making a mistake similar to what the United States made by early on by not agreeing to engage with the Taliban. And furthermore, they're doing something that their leadership themselves have said cannot possibly work. Their leadership has said on several occasions that no one group can rule Afghanistan by itself. But now it looks like they're trying to do that. I'm sure they will prove to be right, and they won't be able to rule Afghanistan in this way.
So in my lifetime, and I'm pretty sure Barney and yourself have seen more of it, I have seen five governments collapse. And it is disheartening every time, and it's tragic that when we experience that. The barometer for my father always told, because that we were used to so much of these turnovers of governments, my father always told us that wait for a year or 6 months, and then if they stayed, then we will take them seriously. That is the barometer for me, that you give the Afghan population normally when a new regime comes and takes over, gives them 6 months to a year. And then you see pockets of resistance starting in the countryside, and then eventually sweep the cities and the urban centers. That's how it has always been. And I mean, I recall some of the words that Barney has written about these things, about how this centrifugal forces and others operate. But essentially, what is happening right now is that the Taliban are sleepwalking into a civil war. Even worse than that, there will be a jihadi fratricidal fight, or what I call jihadi cannibalism. That's why you see ISKP emerging to counterbalance the Taliban, because the resistance is not so much appealing. And Barney is completely on the point there. The ones I talk to inside of Afghanistan, especially in the north, when you talk to them, oh, why didn't you join resistance, or how about the resistance? It's not so appealing. But if you talk to them, you know, why are you, how you want to oppose it, the ranks of ISKP seems to be more appealing to them rather than a resistance. The ISKP, based on information that I have already appointed shadow governors, district governors, provincial governors, even commanders, which is astonishing because of if you compare it to the last three months where their presence was not so wide. Now, Taliban are sitting on a time bomb. It's a matter of time before a social implosion will happen and a civil war will erupt, and it will be the war of all against all in a way. And it will be more dangerous than any time ever in the history of Afghanistan for the Afghan state.
Thank you. I'm going to combine two questions that are being asked about President Biden and his administration in terms of what his real choices were between a permanent presence and the type of withdrawal that we've seen, and how much should he be held accountable for what has taken place. I'm paraphrasing the questions, and if some of you who've asked these questions If you don't think that it's getting to it, please submit your question again. Barney, do you want to start?
There is, and there never has been, an option for a permanent U.S. military presence in Afghanistan. I just mentioned the geography, the countries that control the routes to Afghanistan. None of those countries wants a permanent military presence in Afghanistan, and they can prevent it. In addition, the U.S. military presence sparked a great deal of opposition. We were focused on how they brought, you know, human rights and so on, but they also brought huge amounts of civilian casualties. Afghanistan is divided between those areas where the government is very much present and those areas where the government is pretty absent. And the areas where the government is present benefited from to a certain extent from the international presence. The area where the government is absent, where insurgents were in those parts of it where the insurgents were active, they actually, many of them were hurt by the international presence. And in a way, and the whole U.S. counterinsurgency strategy was a failure. You might say it was a Ponzi scheme because it was supposed to work as an exit strategy that we clear, hold, build, and then transfer those things to the Afghans, and then we can leave. But we never succeeded in building or transferring those things. Tamim has explained how the army that the United States built for Afghanistan, it was an army that could never be transferred, because it was built in the image of the American military. It was not suited for Afghan conditions. And that was simply because the military did what they knew how to do. So the question was, I think that President Biden was correct when he said the question, I'm sure the military advisors did tell him to keep the troops there, because they would always say that, drag it out, keep going a little by little. But he said, I'm just passing on this difficult decision to someone else. And I think that was correct. Now, is it possible to have done it in a better way? Well, he didn't do it the way I recommended. I mean, not that I'm sure that if he'd done that, it would have worked out better. I think that he did not take into account very much, if at all, the effect on Afghans and the effect on the countries of the region. And I think if he had done that, he could have organized it in a much more effective way. But the basic decision of withdrawing U.S. troops from Afghanistan is one that was inevitable. And he was right to say either he made it or he passed it on to his successor.
Thank you. Tammy John, do you want to add anything?
Just quickly, it was the right policy, but it was badly executed. I think his military advisors gave him bad advice on how to go about ending the Afghan war. And I think, you know, and secondly, Biden had a historical luggage with him. I think he had some personal grudges with Karzai and others. Certain personal issues played into his decisions, because some of the things that are coming out right now from the deliberations, it seems that President Biden, no matter what, who gave him what advice, including Barney Rubin, he would have gotten out because I think there were certain personal experience and personal memories involved of his many visits to Afghanistan and his take on it, besides the fact that he was intent on leaving. So it was the right policy, but badly executed, and then certain personal motives played into it.
Thank you. And I'm going to pull together a couple of questions, which is ultimately the sustainability of the reforms that were achieved now that there is no longer the broader state structure, now that there is no aid. What is going to be sustainable, for example, in terms of the internet and connectivity, in terms of women's rights, and what will be the path to sustainability on some of these core areas where there has been significant gains?
Well, I'll just mention one important fact. Afghanistan imports 78% of its electricity from neighboring countries. If you don't have electricity, you don't have an internet. And Afghanistan is now unable to pay for that electricity. So how long will Iran and Uzbekistan continue supplying Afghanistan with electricity for nothing? So actually, none of those gains is sustainable. without foreign aid and without an Afghan government that can engage with the international community. Now, the paradox of the Taliban is that even if they did engage, they don't want to maintain a lot of those gains, maybe some of them, but they don't want to maintain a lot of them. So just giving them more money for will not change their minds. As Tamim said, they're not going to be influenced in that way. But the fact is, all of those gains were dependent on the foreign assistance that financed them. And we can destroy them more quickly by failing to finance them than the Taliban, who haven't gotten very well organized yet, will be able to destroy them through their policies.
Can I also ask you both, I'm being asked about the situation of women, but I also think it would be important to ask both of you, and you know, it's a core concern, and it is the population that has borne the brunt of conflict and now is once again in a situation where many of their most fundamental rights are under threat or for the time being, it has been entirely taken away. Taemin Jung, do you want to add anything in regard to this?
Quickly on the sustainability, I have always taken in a note I've always had problem with the word sustainability, specifically when it comes to development and aid. Development and aid are enablers, but not, it will not be there forever, one. Secondly, I would much prefer the word indigenization. Why? Because that forces people to take ownership and to find creative local ways to deal with things and whether it's the values or whether it's the aid or others. The best example of that is women demonstrations in Kabul and across provinces. Men stayed at home. Women got out in Afghanistan on the streets on the first days of Taliban takeover, where many people were afraid to go and greet them, demonstrated and asked for their rights. You saw the photos, you saw the pictures, you saw the videos of that. Some of my family members were involved into those demonstrations, and you know, men were sitting at home. So that is one good example of indigenization. Afghan people are like people in all parts of the world. They want freedoms. They want liberty. They want to live a peaceful life. They have their limitations of the different forces which are there, but human rights, women's rights, liberties, freedoms are not an alien concept to them and an alien value or principle for Afghans. They need to indigenize and internalize it, and they're doing it now. In terms of the sustainability of the last 22 decades of investment in Afghanistan, it has created a space. 65%, more than 65% of the Afghan population are born after 9/11. They have no memories of the Taliban emirate. I think it would be a mistake on the part of the Taliban to impose their values on this new 65% of the population who are below 24 or 20. That will create a recipe for the Syrianization of Afghanistan, which is the likes that you see, the likes of conflict like in Syria, where people in different localities will fight for their values, for the way they are living. And I think people are, and we have to be careful not to pass on judgments, because Taliban having it finished their 50 days in office now, or in government, if I could put it that way. Let's wait for another year. And I think we are in for quite a ride. I am already seeing people are talking about taking up arms, and primarily it's driven because of lack of service delivery and because of Taliban beating women on the streets and because of all these images that we see and because of the problems that are there in Afghanistan and inside Afghanistan. What I will say is that the last 20 years have created a space, a new generation, and people who have tasted freedom. Whether they will organize themselves into political and military structures that could counterbalance the Taliban, or whether they will join Daesh to counter balance the Taliban or another form, we will have to wait and see. But this current situation is simply unsustainable, and it's sowing the seeds for a full-blown war, whether it's a civil war, a proxy war, another ISKP versus Taliban war or resistance war, I don't know. But Taliban are giving ground to alternative forces, which this particular post 9/11 generation could also take part and become an alternative to basically oppose them.
I just add one thing. Some of the post 9/11 generation tasted more freedom and opportunities. Some of them tasted bombs and violence and displacement. And, they had very, very different experiences. So the whole generation is not composed of Fulbright students. There are very angry young people who know nothing but war. And even some of the older generation of Taliban would talk about how this younger generation is incredibly radical and dangerous. So I think that's where ISKP is getting its recruits. And that's part of where the danger comes from.
Just building on this point and referencing one of the questions, there's a lot of focus on ISKP. Now, if the country collapses, would ISKP be the main the main insurgency that would emerge as the one of the main opposition forces? Or would you see different pockets of resistance, different pockets of Islamists all over the country? What are the scenarios of how things might unfold should the Taliban government collapse?
Well, ISKP thus far is very far from having a national presence. So I would expect the thing about the advantage that ISKP has relative to other potential opposition groups is that it apparently has a relatively well-organized underground terrorist network in both Kabul, surrounding areas, and also in eastern Afghanistan, which controls the supply routes to Kabul, by the way, which is quite important. It has no presence in the majority of the country, in the vast majority of the country. So I would expect that if social order breaks down because of the type of phenomena that Tamim was talking about, you would see a variety of not just of opposition, but just outbreaks of criminal violence and other kinds of violence, people trying to take control of resources and so on, just for the sake of survival. There would be no overall political leadership. It might not even be overall political.
That'll do it for this week's episode of Asia in Depth. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple, Spotify, and YouTube. And check out past episodes by visiting our show page at asiasociety.org/podcast. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Asia Society. I'm Michelle Flor-Cruz. See you next time.